Welcome to The Point. I'm Indy Todd. The proverb, necessity is the mother of invention, seems particularly apropos during this pandemic. COVID-19 has forced us to rethink and innovate on many levels. Later in the hour, we'll discuss innovations in teaching and learning, what's working, and where do challenges remain. But first, remote learning is one of the ways we've kept students in school despite the pandemic. Students in elementary school through high school are meeting their classmates and teachers on video conferencing platforms like Zoom. School assignments are disseminated and completed on a variety of online platforms and can include audio, video, and written work. Technology has also been a double-edged sword. While it's allowed learning to continue despite the pandemic, it might also be causing a spike in online predation of children. Locally, Children's Cove, the Cape and Islands Child Advocacy Center, has seen a dramatic increase in referrals for child sexual exploitation. Today, we discuss how to keep children safe as they spend more of their day online. With us is Jacob Stapleton, Community Education and Outreach Coordinator at Children's Cove. Hi, Jacob.
Hi, good morning, Mindy.
And Janelle Burley Hoffman, a consultant on Raising Tech Healthy Families. She's the author of iRules, What Every Tech Healthy Family Needs to Know About Selfies, Sexting, Gaming, and Growing Up. Hi, Janelle.
Good morning.
And Dr. Sonia Tellier, Assistant Superintendent and Director of Teaching and Learning at the Falmouth Public Schools. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Mindy.
So, Jacob, tell us more about the spike of sexual exploitation cases that you're seeing. What kinds of numbers are we talking about, and when did you start to see the spike?
Well, so Children's Cove, we provide a coordinated response to cases involving crimes against children, so including sexual abuse, severe physical abuse, witness to domestic violence, as well as online exploitation and human trafficking. Last year, we received a little more than 20. We had 22 referrals for what we categorize as commercial sexual exploitation of children. So that was during the fiscal year, so from July 1 to June 30th. Since July 1st this year, we've actually already surpassed our entire numbers for referrals. We're over 25 referrals at this point in time, just since July 1st. And those cases are involving children as young as 6 up to 17. Some of it is including, direct commercial sexual exploitation, human trafficking. But a lot of what we're seeing is online exploitation, where individuals are pressuring or extorting children under the age of 18 for nude imagery, or they're sending imagery, or they're using some type of exploited means to get imagery from them. We're also seeing a really big spike in... Sorry, go ahead, Maddie.
No, go ahead, finish your sentence, sorry.
I said a lot of what we're also seeing as well is situations where as relationships between, teens and youth are becoming more digital because of social distancing and restriction, we're seeing some more, challenges with sexting, and then when relationships end, that those images tend to remain, and then there's some consequences related to that.
So how do predators tend to make contact with children online, and are there apps or other online platforms that are commonly used?
Well, unfortunately, as very much in the real and physical world, wherever there are children, there are going to be individuals that are looking to find ways to take advantage of or exploit children. And so very much in the online world, predators who are trying to find access to children, they are wherever children go. They are on all social media platforms, TikTok, Instagram, Facebook, YouTube. They are in the gaming worlds, Roblox, Minecraft, Fortnite. They're in all of these places, and very similar to that kind of in-person, they try to groom by relationships, by developing friendships, not necessarily being honest about who they are and what their intentions are. Or sometimes they use fear and other tactics with their more advanced knowledge about the online world to take advantage of kids and pressuring them into things that they may not want to do.
Janelle, are there certain apps or platforms you suggest avoiding because they can make children more vulnerable to predators?
There's a lot of thoughts and theories about that. I think rather than it being a focus specifically on a particular platform or a topic, it's really what we're really trying to stress is for parents to be involved. Understanding and knowing what it is that their children are using, what devices in the home have access to the internet, because there's a lot of times where parents may not be aware that those particular devices have the full range of access to the internet, and they're finding themselves into the hands of children that were 7 or 8 years old, and we all know what's on the internet, mm-hmm. and now those children have access to that.
Yeah, Janelle, you want to add to that?
Sure. Yeah, I was going to say that this is really, it's not necessarily app to app or platform to platform. It's really about a foundational level of the relationship between parent, caregiver, educator, and that communication and engagement in education, and also teaching that media criticism and literacy. So we see this now as a foundational skill in parenting. So before it would be this idea of digital parenting or what happens online, but what we really want to see in families is that they're integrating all of the other beliefs, expectations, communication that they do away from the screens now to life on the screens to strengthen and really put on that seatbelt for the parent-child, caregiver-child relationship when they go online. So it isn't necessarily that one place is more dangerous than the other. We should have this foundational, ongoing, dynamic conversation, expectations, and engagement with our children.
Yeah, it can be so confusing, too. Janelle, how do you recommend that parents or caregivers stay up to date on what's safe and what's not, you know, as far as looking at all these different options that kids are doing online?
Yeah, it's such a great question, and I know this is a space that parents are incredibly overwhelmed with. I have deep respect for the work of Children's Cove, being a member of the Cape Cod community and also a parent of five children myself. I absolutely understand that there is a real concern and real safety issue here, but often we stop there. We stop in that panic and that fear and that overwhelmed feeling, and I encourage our listeners and families who are tuning in to not let the fear stop them, because what happens is our children recognize that we might be afraid, tense, resent the technology, not really know the technology. And what they do is they use it in isolation in response to that, right? Or that they might not report because they understand that we might be overwhelmed by it or we might be angry by it. And so one thing that we can really do as parents is remember that we're their askable adults. Right, that the more trusted adults in the life of a young person where they can report something that doesn't feel just right, or they've stumbled across something, or someone's asked them a question about their personal information. We want to make sure that we're not putting up walls where we should be building bridges with our kids and practicing that. And so, of course, there are some incredible resources out there to support parents in their specific education around the apps and platforms like Common Sense Media, Connect Safely, Screenagers. The documentary has an incredible weekly newsletter that they send out with topical information, and the Family Online Safety Institute. Those are my four really national go-to platforms for parents' education and engagement around their own media literacy.
This is a difficult topic, but it's important to discuss what can happen to a child or adolescent once a predator makes contact. So, Jacob, walk us through what is happening to children.
So I think one of the biggest, issues and challenges that we're seeing is making sure that children, very much to what Janelle was saying, was that they have the knowledge and the resource to be able to ask for help. Very similar to in-person, real-life cases of exploitation or abuse, only about 10% of children actually make a disclosure about victimization. And it's even more challenging when that victimization has taken place online, because it sometimes may feel as though the stakes are that much higher because of how much these individuals may say, like, I'll take this picture, I'm going to share it with everyone, I'm going to share it with your family, I'm going to do A, B, and C. And so it becomes incredibly retreated inward. And so really making sure that they're developing that safe place and mechanism and conversation within family systems for children to be able to ask for help is really important. But where we're seeing a lot of challenges is that kind of exploitation piece, that what we call sextortion, where an image is sent or traded or requested, and then feeling pressured, that child or that individual does so. And then that other person on the other end is going to kind of continue to keep pushing and asking and using every means, force, fraud, coercion, to try to get more out of that individual. This could be a unknown person online, and about 80% of the time it is unknown. But then the other challenging aspect of this is that person may be known to them. It may be somebody that they've been in a intimate relationship with. It may be a family member. It may be somebody that has a connection to them, which makes that threat that much more real. And so it's only until they're able to ask for that help that may continue, or even if it doesn't, they're still stuck with that knowledge that this image is out there likely forever, and they don't know when it's going to come up again.
Right. Sonia, what percentage roughly of Falmouth Public students are now engaged in online learning, and how has that changed since the pandemic began?
Well, in the early days when we had the forced physical closure of our schools, we moved to 100%. And as we've reopened, so our phased reopening of schools, we tend to be somewhere between 20 to 25%. There's a bit of flexibility in family choice to be remote, of families who have decided to be exclusively remote. And then for our students in grades 5 through 12, they have a hybrid learning model where they are in for a week and then they are remote for a week. So they do go through that rotation across all grades 5 through 12.
What kinds of safeguards does a school have in place to ensure that only students and staff have access to those platforms?
Well, one of the pieces that I wanted to pick up on, Mindy, from Janelle's comments about Common Sense Media is that we had started well in advance of the pandemic, going through that foundational educational process of building digital citizenship and awareness and working with Common Sense Media resources and our Director of Digital Learning and our library and technology teachers to offer our students a baseline, especially because we had been moving towards the one-to-one deployment of the Chromebook just as a tool in our educational system. On top of that, knowing that we have such a high degree of remote learners and having learned, just lessons in the quick movement towards that remote programming in the spring, we've also been able to change filtering systems both within the current use of the network when students are in the district and then with some additional software, including the Securely Classroom. So it allows our teachers to be able to create sessions for monitoring students while they're in class with them and to provide some assistance and support to students to aid their learning and be able to monitor what the student is doing. However, use of Securely is largely tied to the school day, and then it goes back to the district's filtering system for content on those devices outside of the school day. Mm-hmm.
Janelle, what are you hearing from families about instances of online predation?
So what I hear from families always across my work, whether it's local to Cape Cod or my work nationally, safety is always the utmost concern for families. And so I hear families really curious. I mean, we all acknowledge that there are incredible benefits to technology. And I think that's worth mentioning that there's every time we enter into this topic that there's this duality, right? There are incredible ways that we celebrate the way that our kids can still be in school and have access to information and learning. And we know that having a one-to-one device in a school district is an incredible privilege in our country, and having high-speed internet is an incredible privilege. So we acknowledge that while we also face some of the challenges. And I think that's what's on parents' mind, is that we recognize and normalize that tech is here to stay. And then the question becomes, what are some preventative measures that we can do? And then also thinking about what do we do in response, and that reporting and that relationship component really follows all the way through. So I think that the major concern for parents, of course, like anything else, whether we're talking about sending our kid to do something independently, walk to get a candy bar by themselves for the first time, or go sleep over a friend's house for the first time, safety is always a primary concern. And I think that that's at the root of a lot of what parents want to talk about, knowing that there's just an increase in time online right now for very practical reasons and health and safety reasons, educational reasons, but also for entertainment and socialization, and that there is a component of isolation for our young people now, and it's different and difficult. And I think that idea of safety has to be ongoing, right? It's not just the talk, right? We know that about a lot of issues around parenting right now, whether it's drugs and alcohol or sex and sexuality, that this is an ongoing scaffolded conversation to support our young people. But then there might be moments where we really want to dial in and make it a very regular, very maybe even every day checking in about things, asking about our child's life online in the same way we would ask about any part of their life away from the screens, right? Whether it was a spelling test or a soccer game, that we have that same level of engagement. And I think that's really at the beginning stages of how do we build safe and healthy relationships to our screens.
We are discussing how to keep children safe as they spend more of their day online. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to join the conversation. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're discussing how to keep children safe as they spend more of their day online. With us is Jacob Stapleton, Community Education Outreach Coordinator at Children's Cove. Janelle Burley-Hoffman, a consultant on raising tech-healthy families and the author of iRules, What Every Tech-Healthy Family Needs to Know About Selfies, Sexting, Gaming, and Growing Up. And Dr. Sonia Tellier, Assistant Superintendent and Director of Teaching and Learning at the Falmouth Public Schools. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We talk about online privacy, keeping information about ourselves safe and secure, but the term privacy can also help kids think about the parts of their physical selves that should be kept private, even online. Janelle, how do we talk to students and children about online privacy?
I think we absolutely have to be really direct in these conversations and intentional. We have to be explicit about what we mean. What are our expectations, right? So this can mean reminding our kids on a regular basis that the spaces on the internet are public. Even if you have an Instagram account set to private, even if you feel like you're just having a text conversation with a friend, that everything is shareable and accessible. And so I use this model when I work with students. In particular, about 70% of my work is with middle school students around digital health and well-being. And we talk about this idea of the digital billboard, right? So we imagine that our digital life is displayed in a place where lots of people can see. So what do we want to share that would be broadcast on that digital billboard? And that visual is very concrete for them because they're familiar with that. And so we're also asking kids to think about their digital wallet, right? What belongs in their wallet? What is personal information? We wouldn't hand out the contents of our wallet as we walk down the street. We don't want to hand out the personal information and the contents of our digital wallet as we walk the halls of the internet. So anytime we can give them those examples of things, you know, away from the screens, and we can apply it to life online, it really helps. They're going to need a lot of conversations about this, right? Like anything else. And so giving them very specific tools and expectations about no one should ever ask for personal information. And if they do, I'm here for you, right? So it's that level of preventative work, giving them scripts for conversation, giving them scripts about what happens if someone asks you for a picture, right? And allowing them that cognitive rehearsal so that they have been taught about it, they've practiced it a little bit, but they also know they have trusted and caring adults on their side should they be in a situation like that.
Jacob, how do we talk with our children about sexual predation, either online or in person, and how early do we start those conversations?
So I just want to echo everything Janelle just said, because it's very much the same message that we're encouraging parents to give when talking about body safety. You know, starting very young, 2, 3, 4 years old, about identifying the parts of the body, calling them by their actual names, you know, not using different names for it, so that if they're communicating that there's a problem, they know what part to call it. And so as we have those conversations with children early and often, and incorporating body safety as a part of regular conversation, now that we're seeing children younger and younger spending more time online, I mean, there are some places across the country where they're doing preschool online, then, you know, we have to incorporate those same levels of conversation about online safety. And it doesn't need to be that scary conversation where we're talking specifically about sexual predators, you know, using more age-related and relevant language. You know, sometimes not everything on the internet is safe. Sometimes there are people who are the bad guys, and they may try to find out things about you that you shouldn't tell them. And using those same examples that Janelle talked about is how do you build that safety? What are those elements where you don't share that information? Why do you not share pictures? Just like we have the same conversation with children about fire safety, safety around cooking, safety around weapons or knives, and how to report that if somebody does approach them trying to get that information.
Yeah. Students who are at school for in-person learning often come together on Zoom meetings with their fellow students who are remote. So even if your child is in school, it's likely they are online. So Sonia, schools have safety measures such as Cori checks for people who have access to students while on campus, but we don't necessarily know who's in a student's home that might be watching these Zoom classes off camera. And students' faces and names are there on the screen. Is there a risk there?
Yeah, so one of the things that we've done is built out our telecommunications expectations document, and we offer guidance to both our educators and then through our educators to our students, and able to try and create safeguards so that they have identified spaces within their home. They're minimizing the amount of distraction or movement around them and trying to help them also build those habits. One, so that they can remain an active and focused learner in those environments, but two, to also provide the safeguards from distractions or unintended viewing of anything else that's happening in homes. And then to build on that, just as we are looking at this additional suite of digital tools that are coming in and aiding teaching and learning, we are preparing and will begin our first sessions with a Family Learning Academy the week after the Thanksgiving break. And we've broken those down to the point that Jacob was talking about being developmentally appropriate into different grade groups for families to introduce them to the tools we're using and to give them, in some cases, a bit of a demonstration or trial run in using them. And one of the ones that we are looking at preparing a session for families about is that idea of telecommunication. What does it mean when the students are in the sessions? What does it look like for instructional purposes and just having them test out that environment, but also how securely is used for creating safeguards in the classroom. So there's a variety of ways in which we're trying to approach it, but I really liked the analogy that Janelle made to building the bridge. And being able to open the communication and helping the families understand what the students' expectations are and how they can engage and remain active learners and provide some strategies for supporting that.
Janelle, what are some of the parental controls we should have on our children's devices?
I think the choice to have parental controls really depends on the child and the age and stage of the child. So what I encourage families to do, instead of just prescribing what everyone should do, because what I don't want parental controls to do is to replace the parenting, right? Mm-hmm. There's this great sign I saw in a library once that said, there's no app to replace your lap, right? So the job of parenting is still ours, regardless of the fact that we put on parental controls or some level of digital monitoring. And so the places we can start to go are online with our own carriers, right? The technology hubs, the platforms themselves have a lot of educational tools and controls. For example, we talked about Minecraft and Roblox. You can disable the chat feature on those games, or you can limit who your child plays with. So it's called, in digital citizenship, shrinking the sandbox. So we have a little more control over who our beginners, our early tech users, are engaging with online if we choose to allow them to play a game in community. And so it's about getting to know what platforms our children are using, then also getting to know the carriers, what kind of service and parental controls can the carriers provide? And then do we want to get something for the hardware technology in our home for the router? Or do we want to buy a software app that exists and we want to get to know it? We want to get to know what we're putting on our children's devices. But we also want that relationship part to still be really present, because we can't set and forget. This is the hard work of parenting. And we have to show up and do it in a really regular way. But we also can use some digital tools and support to enhance that parenting.
Yeah, and teens are tech savvy. They can undo some of the safety protocols that we set up, right? So, you know, how we monitor what a teen is doing to find that line between giving adolescents some freedom online, but also while ensuring their safety, gets a little more complicated in the teen years, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And a lot of families will tell me, oh, my kids are just more savvy than I am. And there's kind of this, what can I, you know, the shrug of what can I do about it? But in reality, I want to remind parents of their power. And I mean power in the best sense of the word, that we should not surrender our wisdom and our guidance and our leadership to their savvy, right? So never forget, just because they're part of the digital generation, that they still need us. They still need expectations. They still need people that they can trust. They still need to have that relationship really strong and the connection really strong. And I think that's the most important thing we can give them. If a listener is thinking, where should I start? It's in the attention and energy going towards the relationship and the communication around some of these issues.
Sonia, many students are... I'm sorry. Yeah, go ahead.
Add to that really quickly. And just remembering, too, to echo what Janelle was saying, is that this isn't just a tool. It's not just a device. It's not just a game for kids. As we're pushed more into online worlds of school and work and everything, this is their socialization. This is where they connect. And so being involved with it and understanding what's happening in these online spaces is that important connection piece that helps guide those conversations around safety as well.
Yeah. Sonia, many students are issued school-owned devices. What school controls on school-owned devices are there? Can they be manipulated by someone outside of the school?
So the school device that we issue to students are Chromebooks created by HP, and we deploy the security settings centrally. So they are periodically reviewed and updated, but they are sent out from our director of instructional technology, and they can be monitored regularly. So that's one piece, and then the additional classroom monitoring from the Securely tool. So there is continued monitoring, and any attempt at change, there's a messaging system that's set up and it's sent. We do allow students to add some extensions from the Google suite of tools because the Chromebooks are designed to work with Chrome. But again, it's much of it's tied to that central deployment. They can't just openly pull in any content they want to store. Yeah. And there's settings that will also overnight reset the devices.
Got it. Jacob, what are some signs that a child or teen may have been targeted by an online predator? And how do you recommend initiating a conversation with a child if we have a concern?
So very similar to if there's something going on in person, is there may be some recognition that, you know, there's been some change in behavior. You know, that could be increased isolation. It could be seeing signs of somebody being, you know, sad, seemingly more withdrawn, having challenges with anger or outbursts. Or there just may be more kind of secrecy or behavior change that causes somebody to say, hey, I wonder what's going on with that individual. You know, one of the real challenges, though, is sometimes there may be no signs at all. And so being able to have that place of a safe conversation, being able to check in and asking if everything's okay, or even just directly prompting is, you know, hey, with everything that's going on online, you're spending so much, is there anything that's happened that you want to talk about? Or is there anything that's concerned you or made you upset? Is allowing that place and kind of planting those seeds that even if they don't want to say anything in that moment, knowing that it's a safe thing to talk about. And if a child does make a report that something has happened, you know, there could be a lot of avenues that parents may want to go down or may need, but they can always contact us at Children Cove, at Children's Book, to identify, you know, what are some first steps to take. You know, we always remind parents that if a child does say something or if there's a concern that has been raised, stay calm, be relaxed. You want to make sure that you're showing that you're calm, you're in control, and you're collected. You know, don't take any quick actions such as deleting images or removing apps. Those may be really important to effectively report or to get help. Don't share images. Don't, you know, screenshot them. Don't send them to anybody else. Feel free to contact us, local police department, or the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, if there's something specific that has happened online.
Have we been successful in finding and prosecuting sexual predators?
You know, there's some cases which are still actively under investigation, so I can't comment directly around those. But sometimes, you know, and we also want to stress, too, is not every single one of these cases is that there is a active predator who is, you know, trying to take advantage. Sometimes these are situations involving teenagers who have taken, you know, nudes and selfies and sent them to one another as a part of, you know, unfortunately what we could call as dating social norms. And then something happens within that relationship, and then that image gets shared with somebody else. And then at that point, yes, a crime has been committed. And even taking these photos is technically the manufacturing of child sexual exploitative materials. And sometimes it can be vindictive, it can be spiteful, but it doesn't necessarily mean that it was somebody actively trying to exploit this person. It was a poor decision made by somebody who wasn't thinking as clearly as they probably should have been.
Yeah, although one thing we should keep in mind, and Jacob, I know you know this, is that some of these adult predators, they are very, very manipulative and very convincing, and we need to know that. We need to know how clever they can be.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, when there are these individuals who are spending time online with the explicit intent to take advantage of children, to try to get imagery of children, to try to take nude photos or whatnot, this is what they do. They may work a job during the day, but then at night, this is their job. And they have numerous profiles. They have full setups. I mean, this is they do, and they spend hours upon hours of time doing this. And a lot of the research specifically into those who are online predators is that they would spend oftentimes more time online in these places and chat rooms and avenues for children than they would spend in a workplace or in another environment. And so when you're spending that much time online, they know all of the ins and outs, and these individuals are part of their own community online, where they trade secrets with one another, and they teach each other, you know, tools of what they call their trade, and they're very savvy. And so making sure that parents are staying ahead of this, explaining to children as they get older in a safe and developmentally appropriate way that, you know, there are a lot of unsafe things on the internet, and we need to be able to talk about it. It's critical.
Yeah. Janelle, adolescents can engage in risky or juvenile behavior online without fully understanding the short and long-term implications. They might not realize that an image might attract unwanted attention, or repost could be a red flag to a future employer. How do you talk with teens and their families about these issues?
Yeah, this is a really good point, because for me, I think there's always this concern around the future of a child, right? And so what about college? What about employment? And in reality, our young people are very in the moment. And for me, it's less, I think they tune us out when we try talking to them about when they're 20 or when they're 30. I think we need to talk about what's safe for them right now in this moment, and what's the behavior that we do want to see. So many, many times throughout a day, our kids are making incredibly positive decisions online. Our kids are doing fabulous work, social justice, in big, big movements of digital engagement, helping each other, collaborating, being creative. And so I think sometimes when we take the lens that we're having today around a really important conversation, families might have the urge to like pull the plug on all of it. And in reality, in my work with law enforcement and with people who investigate crimes against children, when we have this very overcorrective response, which is we can't have any of it, what we see is actually, instead of educating, instead of going towards it, we see our kids become more at risk. Because the reality is, even if we took the internet out of our homes, the internet still exists in the world, right? The internet is at a friend's house, it's on the school bus, it's in the classroom, it's at the public library. So there isn't a world where technology and internet and being connected to other people doesn't exist. And so I just wanted to make that point, that if everyone's having that fear response of let's get rid of it, the reality is the response, as hard as it is to hear, is go towards it. What can we know more about it, and how can we do more work around it? And that actually makes a child safer. So it might feel a little counterintuitive, but staying the course and really thinking about it and engaging is actually the safer option in this way. And also, our young people need to be rewarded. They need to be told what the expectation is. Just if you think about a child who you're asking them to hang their jacket up every day after school in their backpack, we know if we want to see more of that behavior, we celebrate that behavior. And so if they're turning off their device at night when we ask them to, or they're saying, oh, this person I don't know is requesting to follow me on TikTok or Instagram, should I allow it, right? If they're checking in with an older sibling or with a parent or a babysitter, these are really great and healthy and safe behaviors. And so often we zone in on the things we don't want. We zone in on the things we're afraid of. And instead, I think we need to take a step back and be really mindful that we're celebrating the great things that our kids do, because believe it or not, our adolescents and teenagers, they still want to make their parents and caregivers and teachers very happy. They still want our approval. They're actually craving it, especially in the digital space, because they hear plenty of the scary stuff, which is important and it needs to be part of the conversation. But they also need to know that we believe in them. We believe in their ability to make good decisions. We believe in their ability to be discerning. We believe in their ability to ask questions and to get the help that they need. So I think when those two things coexist together, that's when we really see a tech-healthy young person.
Right. I will post links with more information about keeping kids safe at our website, capeandislands.org. Jacob Stapleton, Community Education Outreach Coordinator at Children's Cove, and Janelle Burley-Hoffman, Consultant on Raising Tech-Healthy Families, author of iRules, What Every Tech-Healthy Family Needs to Know About Selfies, Sexting, Gaming, and Growing Up. Thanks for joining us. Dr. Sonia Tellier, Assistant Superintendent, Director of Teaching and Learning at Falmouth Public Schools, is going to stay with us, because after this short break, we discuss how the pandemic has created innovations around teaching and learning. Stay with us.